Coming up on this week's episode of Check Your Balances, how much would it take to get you to switch banks? We talk about that and Michael Lewis's new book. Stick around. That's coming up next.
Check Your Balances is a show produced and owned by Kraftwerk Capital. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are personal opinions and should not be considered personal financial advice or the opinion of Kraftwerk Capital. All investments have risk and may lose money. Consult with your financial advisor, tax preparer, or attorney prior to implementing anything discussed, and please do not use this show as the sole basis for financial decisions.
Welcome back to another week of Check Your Balances. I am Ross Anderson, joined as always by my friend and co-host, Dan Maseka. Good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you as well.
You are looking nice in another Crooked Crab shirt. I think these are going to continue to make an appearance on the podcast.
They will. Honestly, almost all of my casual wardrobe is Crooked Crab gear because for the last 5 or 6 years, it's all I've bought and we're living at home. I've also sized up over the last 5 or 6 years. So everything in my current size happens to be Crooked Crab. I'll continue to represent the brand though.
Yeah. It's just going to look like we're plugging the brewery, which in a way we are, but our show is not sponsored by anybody, including several banks, which is going to be evident by what we're getting into in just a moment here.
I love joking, and maybe we'll joke this into fruition about gaining sponsorship from like very large corporations. If anyone wants to pay us, I'm willing to listen to your pitch.
Honestly, I'm glad that we're not sponsored. I like that we can basically just joke on anybody on this show within reason and make fun of whatever company we want, and that's fine. So I appreciate the independence. I'm also not against getting paid to do this, but for what it's worth, I like the fact that we are completely independent in our presentation of our podcast.
I'm more with you than not with you in that statement.
All right. So speaking of people that won't sponsor us for this take,
but we'll pay you.
They would potentially pay us individually, not as podcast hosts. I got an email today offering me a pretty meaningful sum of money to switch banks. Now, Dan, what is your threshold for you to uproot a banking relationship or start a new one? And those are two very different things. But what is your threshold of how much you need to be paid before that would get your attention?
As I reflect on what I'm about to say, I understand that I do not approach this from a rational lens. Like any sum of money that I see is often enough like to that it should move the dial for me. But I see deals of like 100, 200, 250 all the time. And for some reason, like up to 250, I'm like, that sounds like a headache because it always involves a direct deposit switch, which reflecting on our situation could not be easier for the two of us. It is
correct.
Like I'm in charge of our payroll. I go in, I push a couple buttons, and we have completed that requirement.
Yes.
It's done. But up to 250, I kind of let it pass by and I'm like, I don't want to start a new banking situation. I'm just going to sit this one out.
Yeah. So the offer that I got today was from Chase Bank. I don't know how universal this is. So if you have Chase, or I guess if you don't have Chase and you're getting emails from them, I'm very curious if other people have gotten this offer. The requirement was a checking and a savings account together for a bonus of $900. Now, there were several stipulations there. I think the savings account had to be funded with something like $15,000, so not an insignificant amount of money. You've got to move a pretty decent chunk of a cash reserve, assuming you've got that cash sitting somewhere already. The checking account did require direct deposit of, I think, at least $500 a month, so you can't just put a token $25 a month in there, which I have done before. I have opened to take these banking promos before, and I've just kind of put a token $50 or whatever because it satisfies their direct deposit requirement and moves you on past it. But $900 is pretty meaningful. And I did the math on basically what you're giving up because I've got two other savings relationships right now. UFB Direct, which I've talked about and basically deeply despise their user experience, but they pay just an incredibly high rate of interest. I think at like 5.25%. And Marcus, which is at 4.4%, which is a smaller account for me. So, you know, relative to those, if I was going to move a $15,000 chunk to Chase and park it for the minimum 3 months, I basically did the math on what I'd be giving up. So you know, $15,000 if you are over the course of a year at 5.25% would be $787 of interest. Break that down to 12, it's about $65 a month. So 65 over 3 months, I would earn otherwise $200 of interest on keeping 15 grand in my current savings relationship at the highest rate I can get on savings or seem to be able to find. To move that to another institution and for the same 3 months get $900 is like finding $700 in the street. That's kind of a lot.
Yeah, I want in on that deal. When you sent me the note, I was like, yeah, can you forward me that link, please?
Yeah, I mean, that's a meaningful bonus that they're giving. And the interesting thing is, and obviously this is why I was joking that we're not sponsored by Chase. I'm not going to leave that money there in a below market interest environment for more than the 3 months I have to. It's just not what I'm going to do. I would basically move it over, collect my check, and then move it back. And I'm going to get a 1099 at the end of the year, which is going to mean it's taxable. But I think that's probably worth the hassle for me for $700. It's not going to take that long, could it?
No, I mean, everything's online. It's super easy these days. But the truth is, you might move the money back. Banking relationships are super sticky, as is evidenced by the fact that someone could throw $200 at me and I'd be like, eh, let me just keep my money here. It's easier. So I think they are going to win assets if they're spreading this deal far and wide in a time where a lot of banks are bleeding money because people are finding the higher interest option. So whatever you can do to keep someone in your ecosystem is probably a win for the bank.
I actually thought it was fascinating that we got a call on the same thing in our business account after we moved some money out.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't bank with UFB personally. My only experience is through you, and I know they pay really high interest, but I hear about the customer service issues all the time. So when you got a call from them on our business account, I was kind of impressed.
Which is, and again, I don't understand why there's two brands here. If somebody works at the bank and wants to call us and tell us this, fine. But UFB Direct is basically part of Axos Bank. Axos is who we were using for our primary business operating account. And we were moving some cash out of there into a higher yielding business relationship with Live Oak Bank, whatever. I can plug whoever we're actually using on this, because I think it was like 4% even on a business account, which again, fairly rare. And we got a call from them basically saying, hey, is that why you're moving the money? And we were like, yeah, of course. And they offered to upgrade that account, which, to my complaints with them, that's exactly my issue, is that you either have to ask for or they have to present you with the better product. You don't ever get it automatically with them. But if your main goal is high interest, they seem to have it. They seem to be willing to pay it. It's just a matter of constantly dealing with that bank.
Right, right. Like, with your personal account, you had to identify that there was a higher interest rate available in the same product that you own, essentially, and then present them with that information and then be like, all right, I guess we could put you in that one.
Yeah. Can I have the better thing that you are currently advertising me but not giving me as a customer of yours? And that's, again, what this experience has been. But to their credit, that did stop the bleeding, right? I think we moved some money out and then they were like, hey, we can upgrade this account to the equivalent interest that we were going to get at Live Oak. And we were like, okay, fine, we'll leave the cash there.
Yeah, it's going to work. It's easier to just leave it.
It is. Yeah. So, you know, maybe the other, I guess I don't know what the lesson is here, right? There's just like a pain threshold for all of us where you're willing to go through the effort of that new relationship. I have had a Bank of America relationship forever. There's so many things tied into it that are on auto pay or whatever. I still think even if I go over and move my direct deposit and move all of this other stuff to Chase, I'm probably going back to Bank of America. And I hate them. I deeply dislike them as a bank. And at the same time, it is so sticky because that's what Chase is hoping I will do, is plug all of my stuff into that direct deposit. But it's probably not going to happen. Now, Bank of America doesn't love me either because I don't leave any cash there. But I'm constantly fascinated by what I'm being offered and what actually catches my eye. But when you get close to a four-figure number, if you're going to give me $1,000 to change banks, that's at least going to catch my eye.
Right. I mean, you couldn't take a day off work and do something and earn more than $1,000 easily. Like, you'd need a special skill set to do that.
Yeah. And it's not going to take me a day. It's going to take me 20 minutes because I'm very comfortable doing this stuff. I'll give them exactly what they need and I'll breeze on through it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. That wasn't the main topic that we wanted to talk about today. We've clearly gone down a rabbit hole of banking relationships, but I do think it's at least relevant to our audience. So let us know if you're out there, if you're getting even better offers than that. Has anybody been spicier than $900 to switch banks? I would love to hear about it. Check
Send
your
us
balances.
Your referral link. We'll get you some money while we sign up for the same deal.
Yeah, no kidding. Exactly. If you're getting a better offer than that, we've clearly just told you we'll do it. So send it our way. Dan, you just read the new Michael Lewis book, and that's what we really wanted to get into today, is the new Michael Lewis, which is on the Sam Bankman-Fried situation. So his book is called Going Infinite, The Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon. I haven't read it yet. I have the audiobook queued up. I'm getting ready to listen to it because that's how I tend to consume more books than not. But Dan, you've gotten through this because you already went on a trip and had some time. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, it was a really good read. I got the book a couple days ago as I was getting ready to go on a mini vacation. So I basically spent my plane ride reading this thing. It was a fascinating story. And it's a very interesting time for it to come out too, because as we speak, Sam Bankman-Fried is sitting in the courtroom defending himself against the United States of America. So reading the book, which really focuses on the background of the creation of FTX and Alameda and who these people are, with less time spent on the controversy at the end, because we're still going through it right now, and then being able to transition immediately to the court case and seeing the evidence coming out and how that's going to play out, I thought was really interesting. So the second I finished this book, I went right to the podcasts with the daily summary of what's happening in the courtroom. So I highly recommend the book. Anyone who's read Michael Lewis knows that it's very easy reading. He's very conversational in the way he presents things and really focuses on interesting characters. Before we get into the meat and potatoes of it, I did want to mention one funny thing that came up in the final pages of the book is they were talking about Sam Bankman-Fried kind of awaiting his trial while at his parents' house. And they couldn't afford very like heavy duty security, but what they did buy is a guard dog German Shepherd, which made me laugh because our very last podcast talked about writing off the cost of a defense dog, which I guarantee is what they're doing.
That is amazing. The fact that it ties back in unexpectedly to last week. And by the way, if you haven't checked out our YouTube channel yet, I was really proud of the thumbnail, which is this like very non-guard dog looking dog. And the graphic just says, can you write off your dog? I don't know. I was very amused while I did that. And if you haven't checked that out yet, all of our new shows are being put up on YouTube. But that's an incredible tie-in. Yeah, I'm sure they wrote that off because in that case, it probably was legitimate. It was the right breed. And hopefully it was a certified dog and they are tracking their expenses properly.
Yeah, Sandor. They flew him in directly from Germany. He speaks German. Sam does not speak German. So his parents are apparently the only ones who could give him the appropriate commands to kill as needed.
That's amazing. So he's got a dog and he can't even tell it what to do because it doesn't speak the language?
Yeah, apparently, according to Michael Lewis, he doesn't give a rat's butt about this dog, but his parents felt it was important.
All right,
and they're probably right.
That's a nice transition point because it doesn't seem like he's cared about a whole lot. And I think that that's where a lot of this controversy has come from. So there's been some criticism of the book, quite frankly, that Michael Lewis has kind of been snowed by Sam Bankman-Fried, or that he's been kind of lured into whatever this vortex of his ability to convince people that he's intelligent and has all these great ideas and is this sharp guy and not a fraudster, right? And so coming away from the book, and I realize we're going to have more and more evidence come out as the trial continues, what was your take? I mean, does he come across as like a bumbling genius that like simply didn't understand the math, or does he come across as Bernie Madoff that was intentionally being deceptive with how he was running his business?
I think my two takeaways from the book of Sam Bankman-Fried are, one, that he is unemotional. Like, emotions don't play any role in the decisions he makes. All the decisions are made based on his calculations in his head of a probability. And every time he sees a slight edge, and it can be minuscule, that one positive thing will happen over a negative thing, he will take that bet, as you are trained to do, because he used to work at a high-frequency trading firm called Jane Street. And they really hammered that into you, is if you see a slight inefficiency and can get a tenth of a percent edge on something else, you hammer that bet as frequently as you can, because you're going to come out ahead, even if you might be losing for a little bit. And I think that's who he is. And he, my take is, he built this vision of a thing that had the engine to generate tons of money, which in theory, he's an effective altruist. He would have used to do what he determined were good things in the world, presumably. And he just felt like he was on the right side of that coin, whether it be by like a tenth of a percent or more. And it didn't matter whether what was happening was bad at the moment, because he felt he could outrun it in the long run. So I think maybe he didn't set out to cause fraud. That's up for debate, certainly. But he definitely found himself in a position where he felt like by any means necessary, he should keep the engine going. And that's what he did.
And we've talked about this before. That's essentially how it works to run a casino. Right? Like if you're running a blackjack table where the odds say the blackjack table is going to beat the player over time, but you could go on a meaningful losing streak, right? I mean, that's basically how a casino runs. A player could take you for $100,000 or $1,000,000 one night, and over time you're going to get that back because the game is designed to win statistically. So he was basically playing just the number of reps that are required to do that. We tend to think of the stock market, quite frankly, under the same lens. You can invest money in the stock market and you could experience really big losses. Your first year in the stock market, if it was 2008, you might have lost 40, 50% of the value of your initial investment. And you go, wow, this thing sucks. Why would anybody do this? If your first year investing was 2022, you might look at the market and go, wow, this thing sucks. Why would anybody do this? But the key is that statistically, over time, you're going to win as long as history continues to play in the way that it has in the past, right? And we don't know that. We're not fortune tellers, but we believe there's enough evidence that it will continue to work in that fashion. So that's really who he was as a thinker, but was not necessarily a gambler on the other side of it, which is kind of how he's being portrayed, is this guy that was making these crazy bets.
Yeah, and they... I mean, quite frankly, I think a lot of them were crazy bets. He just thought they were positive future value bets. So crypto world is wild. And he owned a ton of coins that had no intrinsic value necessarily and owned large stakes in them, which meant that his firm, even if they were valuable, couldn't liquidate them because they had such a large percentage of the market that there wouldn't be a buyer on the other side, or at least at a price that was reasonable to them. And among all these other things that were happening in the background, they were unorganized, they had bad internal controls. He had no list of who actually worked at the company. He couldn't provide one to anyone who walked up. It's amazing. But liquidity was a big deal too. So even if on the books they were solvent, they weren't functionally solvent because they had all these things they couldn't sell on top of tons of money that they allegedly misplaced or lost, which is crazy to hear about too.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. Just and we've talked about this with Silicon Valley Bank. We've talked about this in a bunch of different layers. If the asset that you have isn't worth what you think it is, or if you're going to have to take a huge loss to sell it, you know, there's an argument to be made that you should be marking that to market, or that, you know, it should be ultimately marked way down to whatever the current selling price would be. Letting any bank or financial institution own so much of the product that the very nature of selling it would essentially devalue it to nothing, that's a very scary proposition. And, you know, it's so funny. I get really frustrated with the banking industry, right? And we've talked about this a bunch of different times. When I think about the fact that I couldn't get a mortgage because I don't fit into the Fannie Freddie box right after I sold my house, it makes me really angry, right? Because I'm a person that has essentially taken on responsible debt my entire life. I have never defaulted on a single penny to anyone. I have good credit. I had income, right? I had assets. Like there was no reason not to lend to me. And then when I think about how banks work, it just pisses me off. And at the same time, somebody on the other side that is like a freewheeling, like completely reckless, like, yeah, that'll be fine. I think that guy will pay his bills, right? That rigidity is basically what protects our banking system, is that it is so structured and so risk averse in terms of its design. But crypto just doesn't have any of this regulation, right? do you think regulation would have stopped, or at least, because my understanding is that really what took them down was the Alameda being able to dip into customer accounts, right? That can't happen in an unregulated manner if there's actual guidelines put in place, right? Or am I overstating the value of what the regulators could do with like a real capital requirement on a crypto firm?
No, I think you're right. I think regulation would have helped immensely. And the ironic thing is the FTX company was trying to present themselves as pro-crypto regulation. That's how they were going to try to get on U.S. soil, because the company wasn't legally able to operate in the U.S. except in a limited capacity. So they were petitioning for regulation and government oversight, and then got caught doing all the things that that would have prevented. So I think there is a chance to legitimize crypto exchanges. By the way, FTX, also a futures exchange, which isn't the same as just a normal trading platform. But yeah, certainly dipping into customer funds that were supposed to be sequestered away and basically held for them is not what you want from any institution. And I think if most of them knew that was an option between the two entities, right? Because a bank uses deposits and leverages them into loans. Like, that happens all the time.
I mean, that's almost exactly what they're doing, right? That is the business model. It's not like that's not a bug. That's a feature of a bank.
Right, which is a defense that I suspect Sam Bankman-Fried is going to use. And then the prosecution is going to be like, you are not a bank. The banks can do that. You are not a bank. But the record keeping between the two entities was non-existent. So the people coming in at the end in the bankruptcy proceedings are literally like blindly trying to guess where money ends up. I think they found $8 billion that was just unaccounted for in the months following the bankruptcy, just with random exchanges calling them and saying, hey, we have $450 million of yours. Like, do you want it? And they'd be like, yeah, thank you. Like, please send that back.
It's a
crazy story.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because it ties into so many of the things that we've talked about, right? Like, when we talked about some of the estate planning issues and just the idea of how do you even account for all of this stuff in the way that most of us run our financial lives, right? We're in a paperless world. For the most part, we're not getting paper statements. So it's not like you could just take the quarter after somebody passes away and take all the paper statements that come in. You basically have to be able to access their email and hope that it's all going to the same place, or that there's a catalog somewhere of where this stuff is, because without them being able to answer, if they don't know, first of all, because they've been careless enough that they don't remember where they put their money, or they haven't recorded it properly, I mean, you can absolutely lose money, and not in the sense that you're losing value, but you can just misplace lots and lots of money these days.
Totally. And actually, I went through this with a client recently, but even while you're alive, you can misplace money. I forget if we talked about this, but there are state-run websites that help you find lost money if you think you might have something from years ago in a state where you lived. So just a helpful reminder to go check on that if you have like an old 401k from 20 years ago that you forgot about.
Yeah, if they can't find you or they can't find the address, it's still going to be, at least since the Know Your Client laws have been passed, it's going to have your social security number on it. So there should be some tracking mechanism. I mean, back in the day, you could open a brokerage account basically with a handshake and a smile, but that hasn't been the case, at least for quite a while.
Yeah, I think after a certain statute of limitations, money escheats back to the state. I think that's the word. And then they basically hold on to it until someone comes and claims it.
Well, obviously, this is going to be something we continue to follow as the trial continues. I mean, what was your takeaway from it on who this guy is? Like, is he a genius in your mind? Obviously, he made plenty of mistakes, but what is your current impression of Sam Bankman-Fried, and obviously leaving that plenty open to interpretation as the legal system plays out?
Yeah, I wouldn't call him a genius necessarily, but he's definitely a visionary in the sense that there are a lot of like very big picture visionaries out there today who you might not consider a genius. But he was someone who inspired like-minded people with his vision and got them to rally around it under the framework of effective altruism. People thought they were working for this common good. They were making money to do good. And his circle all was fully invested in that. I think he pushed it forward. And I suspect that somewhere along that path, he like dipped his toe into something that he shouldn't have done and couldn't go back on that in the spirit of getting the end result he was looking for. So I think that's a common story. Like at some point you don't set out to do something bad. You get stuck, you make a decision, and you can't find yourself reversing out of it. That's my takeaway.
Yeah, I wish I could remember whose study talked about this, but they say basically the most common path to large fraud is getting away with a small fraud, right? You do something small that's wrong and you realize that you can get away with it. So it's not necessarily inherently good or inherently bad people, even though we would like to think that. We would like to think that people that commit fraud are inherently bad and we can just like categorize them as like an evil person and just put them in that box, but that it typically spirals. I think that was certainly the case with Bernie Madoff. And again, I like what he did was evil. I'm not saying he is not a bad person for what he ultimately did. He lost billions and billions of people's hard-earned money, but that it started with much smaller things and then just kind of spiraled out of control. Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to watch what ultimately happens with this. And I mean, for what it's worth, we desperately need some crypto regulation. If it is ever going to get beyond just being kind of a token coin. And I really like, it feels silly to talk about it in those terms because it is already such a large effective market cap and has attracted so much worldwide attention and capital. But we got to figure that out. I mean, it just can't exist in the shadows and in an unregulated state where people can't trust the system.
Right. There are no safeguards in place. It's just this is the Wild West in crypto, and you sometimes don't even understand what you're buying or owning.
Well, Dan, I appreciate your take on the book. The book is Going Infinite, The Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon. That was by Michael Lewis. I'm going to be checking that out shortly, and we will continue to follow as the courts unfold what ultimately is going to happen here as a result to Sam Bankman-Fried and whether or not he's going to spend the rest of his life behind bars. A lot going on in that space. For those of you that have questions for the show, checkyourbalances@outlook.com is the email address for us. We appreciate you tuning in. Check it out on YouTube if you haven't done so already, and we will catch you all next week.